Welcome to Psych Pearls podcast by Psychiatric Times. With thoughtful insights into the world of psychiatry, this podcast provides timely clinical commentary and practical cutting-edge pearls for you and your practice. We hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I am Paul Gleason with Psychiatric Times. Our guest today is Dr. James L. Noel IV. He is Director of Forensic Psychiatry and Professor of Psychiatry at SUNY Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. He has published over 150 papers, and in 2020, the American Psychiatric Association awarded him the Seymour Pollock Award for his contributions to the field of forensic psychiatry. He's also Editor-in-Chief Emeritus of Psychiatric Times. Dr. Noel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Paul. James is fine, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you too. So, you have a long history as a forensic psychiatrist of studying and treating people who are, in your words, morally objectionable. So first, what do you mean by that term, morally objectionable?
Well, I struggled for some time, Paul, to come up with a satisfactory term. Because, over the years in psychiatry, we have problems with labels and terms, and they tend to take on different meanings and connotations over time. So I really grappled with trying to find a term that was somewhat neutral to describe patients that we need to treat, but who most people would find objectionable or have strong negative countertransference reactions to, beyond just the ordinary clinical scenario. I'm talking about patients in the forensic system or in the criminal justice system.
Right. And just to be real clear, you don't need to give us any specific cases, but what kind of things will these patients have done?
Very often, they've been relegated to the absolute lowest rung in the prison hierarchy. So folks may or may not know, but there's a very strict social hierarchy or ladder in corrections. And at the very top, those getting the most respect from other inmates are killers of law enforcement. Next come just general killers. Then underneath them come people who committed crimes out of cleverness. So fraud, bank robbery, things like that. And then at the very bottom of the rung are the sex offenders. And within that world, at the very bottom of the barrel are the sex offenders of children. So when I'm speaking of morally objectionable patients, I mean the whole gamut of them, but in particular, those towards the bottom who have been shunned, even in corrections.
So yeah, why do they tend to be the ones that get that psychiatric care? Is it because they've been shunned by everyone else?
I think that's part reason. You see, it's a fascinating question about what from where does mental illness come from in corrections? It's both imported and inculcated. So folks can come in already with their own mental illnesses, but then they can develop mental illnesses quite readily and easily because of the environment that they're in.
Right. So if somebody comes in and is, has done something really horrible, they may develop depression or anxiety disorders based on their prison environment and how people treat them there.
Indeed. And one of the more eye-opening things to me, when I very first started my forensic training, I learned from my mentor, Dr. Phil Resnick. He wrote a brilliant paper on how some folks will, for example, since most of us are not psychopathic without empathy, to kill another person has effects on oneself. And so very often some people will have PTSD or depression from the very crime that they committed.
Yeah, okay, you're talking about things like psychopathy and PTSD. What are the kind of psychiatric conditions or psychological traits that are most common in this population?
Yes, this is a great question. Let me back up because you reminded me of a quick story. When I very first started my forensic and correctional career, I was young and naive and full of motivation. And the commissioner of corrections took me aside and told me that he wanted me to do a deep dive of the use of antidepressants in corrections, because he believed that it was normal and appropriate for inmates to feel sad and depressed if they had to spend time in prison. And so in order to, you know, do my job well and keep on good terms with the commissioner, I had to inform him that, you know, we're not skipping down the halls, passing out Prozac to people. We're really putting out serious fires of serious mental illness. But serious mental illness such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and the like are present in corrections in much higher numbers than out in the community. And so really, the task is to treat these very serious mental illnesses, and also to form a vigorous suicide prevention network and procedure and policy, because that's the ever-present, just by virtue of being in prison, one's suicide risk is increased.
Right. You mentioned some of these conditions, but first I want to talk about the prevalence of these patients, both in the prison population and in the population at large. What are the numbers there?
In terms of, for example, schizophrenia, it's about 4 to 5 times the general public, what you see in the general public. In jails, by the way, let me give a quick breakdown on the difference between jails and prisons. Most folks may not know that. Jails, you can consider, they're sort of the psychiatric emergency room of the correctional system. It's people who usually haven't been sentenced yet, so they're pretrial detainees. They've been charged and arrested, and they're in jail awaiting their trial or sentencing. And so they're really just right off the street in their most shocked and humiliated and untreated state, and possibly very often using substances. Prison is more long-term, and they tend to put prisons out, way out in the boondocks, and people stay there for more serious crimes like felonies for many, many years. So you're able to get to know them better, treat them over a longer period of time, whereas jails are very fast and quick. People are coming in and out. And so it's no surprise then that in jails, the suicide rate is approximately 6 times that of the general public.
And out in the general public, are we looking at this population growing, or are we just kind of more aware of them these days?
You know, I think that it's a little bit of both. But I still don't think that we really fully know yet the extent, because it's just my opinion that we haven't yet put enough resources into studying and following this, or as much as we should.
Mm-hmm. What would you be hoping to find? Like, if you could design a research question, what would you be after right now?
You know, I think I would be after which fences are leading people into kind of this tar pit of the correctional system where they can't get out. They'll get in. There's some preliminary and good research showing that folks with serious mental illness tend to spend longer times in corrections for obvious reasons. They end up getting more infractions. They're less able to work with their attorneys on appeals and so forth. So this is why in the field, one of the big hopeful efforts are the mental health courts. But I think we have got a lot of room to improve in terms of mental health courts.
Could you say a bit more about that? What do you mean, mental health courts?
Yeah. So what you have is an invested judge who is interested and invested in mental health and understands the problem of transinstitutionalization, that is, the movement of folks with serious mental illness into corrections as the new asylum instead of hospitals or outpatient treatment. And so you have a judge who's knowledgeable and invested, and he has a caseload in a particular jurisdiction. He or she has a caseload, and the goal is to divert into treatment and away from corrections. That's kind of a general broad overview.
Right. And once they're diverted into treatment, whether in the corrections facility or outside of it, they sound like very difficult patients to treat. What kind of unique challenges do these morally objectionable patients pose?
Sure. Well, let me make it clear that the vast majority, in my experience, are not morally objectionable. That I took that term from a book chapter that I wrote where I was describing a very specific, small population of folks who have who are high in psychopathy, antisocial personality disorder, and make themselves make their lives generally difficult for themselves and other folks, even in corrections. The vast majority of folks with serious mental illness in corrections are very much like those in public psychiatry. They just happen to have been swept up into the net of criminalization. So they're very much like folks that people would see in a community clinic.
Right. So for them, treatment might be pretty similar. But talking about that little percentage, are there unique challenges there?
Oh, for sure. And, you know, the main challenges are, well, first, engagement in treatment. And then what are the goals? At the present point in time, you know, our ability to affect, personality change on folks with lifelong psychopathic traits is not that good. But we can teach them life skills and how to try to stay out of trouble. Some of the more interesting treatments that have been developed in that area come from Dr. Robert Hare and his colleagues who have developed psychopathy treatment programs. Mm-hmm. Also, new therapies such as motivational interviewing and mentalization seem to be somewhat helpful. But this has always been a long struggle forever. In the UK, they passed a law called Dangerous and Severe Personality Disorder, where they civilly committed, just as we here in the United States civilly commit sex offenders after their sentences. And there, they will civilly commit people with psychopathy and dangerousness, potentially indefinitely. Now, the research they put out so far doesn't overwhelm us with the positive response, and it's costly. So I think that society is struggling with this issue right now.
As you said, you know, there seem to be new therapies coming online, but the prognosis still seems pretty poor for many people with like psychopathic traits.
That concludes the first half of the Psychiatric Times Psych Pearls interview with Dr. James Knoll. Join us later this week for the second half of the interview, where Dr. Knoll reveals what got him into forensic psychiatry in the first place and what it's taught him about taking care of his own mental health and well-being. We hope you'll tune in.